Welcome to the History of Networking, where we drag all of the skeletons out of the wiring closet and ponder the ghosts of protocols past.
Well, hello, Donald. You're in front of the turtle today. I find that fascinating.
And it's probably what you're going to see me for the near future. Being stuck at home.
Being stuck at home. Well, usually you have bikes and guitars, so that's okay. So, Kevin Herbert joins us today. I think you're in San Jose, Sunnyvale, something like that.
My home's in San Francisco. My girlfriend's in Colorado, but these days I'm in South Florida with my parents who are having health issues. So,
Kevin, why don't we start from the very beginning and just talk about, I don't know, do you want to start with how you got into networking, or you want to start with comm servers?
Networking, because one kind of flows into the other. So I, early in my career, was working for Digital Equipment Corporation. I was an operating system developer working on this 16-bit operating system for a PDP-11 computer called Ristis E. And I was kind of a operating system like jack of all trades. We're like all over the kernel. And but this was before TCP/IP took over the world. All companies had their own different kind of networking protocols. DEC had their DECnet protocols, and I was working on DECnet. Became a DECnet developer for Ristis E. One thing led to another, and that led me over to Cisco Systems right around the beginning of the TCP/IP world.
Okay. So you were at Cisco. What year did you join Cisco?
1990.
So 6 years before I did. Interesting. Way before Donald did, I think.
It was 98.
98.
99. So, I don't know.
Yeah, something
does
like
it matter
that.
Anymore?
No, it doesn't matter anymore. It was just interesting. All right, good. Joined Cisco, and you were mostly working on operating system stuff, down in the kernel and stuff. How did you get wrapped up in Cisco? Because Cisco wouldn't have been doing a lot of operating system stuff at that time.
Well, I was doing the DEC networking stuff, and they needed someone who understood DEC's networking protocols. They also needed someone who understand, they wanted someone to work on their, well, then we called them terminal servers, now we call them communication servers, and I had worked on a lot of kind of serial devices, so I knew how all the UARTs and all those idiosyncrasies, and I also knew, because again, everyone was on their own proprietary protocol, DEC had a protocol called LAT for their remote terminal access protocol. So I ended up doing, you know, OS things for, so that was what Cisco IOS was. It was just basically a bare metal application. So I did all kinds of OS things, including the drivers to talk to, you know, the terminal line hardware and everything from that and the high level communication protocols.
Right. As I recall, Cisco IOS, as we would say, classic now, I guess.
Yes. We didn't even call it IOS then. We called it like the system software, you know. Didn't even have a name.
Is a run to completion system, which switches packets in interrupt context. In fact, at that time, it probably didn't even have interrupt context, did it, for switching packets?
Probably did. It had to.
Oh, yeah. That was actually what fast switching was. What we called fast switching was the switch a packet in the interrupt path.
Right. But I didn't know what year that came in.
Just a little before I got there, like 88, 89. Yeah.
Okay. All right, because I know it wasn't always there. It was something that was added at some point. So 80, 89. So, and that's before there were, that was before Tony Lee tried this whole game of playing the first FPGA down in the Silicon Switching Engine, in the SSE. So that's...
So when I started, we had the MCI, which was the generation before that, the multiport communication interface. And that was where a packet would be read. There would basically be four communication ports, so they had common packet memory. And then the CPU could sniff a little bit of the packet header and say, oh, transmit this back out, like port 2 or 3 or whatever. So the CPU didn't have to see all the packets. And there were these it used VLIW, very long instruction word. They had these quad 2901 bit slice processors to do the work. And then that turned into the whole SSE switching complex. But this was like generation one was just, it was the MCI. It had four ports. It was a fixed fixed design thing, and then they turned it into a complex. But it's the same basic idea.
Okay, interesting. So talk to us about the original comm servers. What problem was trying to be solved with these devices? Because a lot of people don't even know what they are any longer.
It kind of requires a bit of a history lesson. You know, first computers might have had one or two terminals on them, where the terminal connection was slow speed, serial bitstream, like something 9600 baud, and you have a limited number of terminals. And each of those terminals were directly connected to some kind of interface card, which went into the backplane. And that's how two or, you know, a few small number of people would share a computer. Well, as the computers got faster, they had the same idea, but they thought, well, we could put, you know, 10 terminals on this. But then it started to be too much backplane space. So they came up with a card that had 8 ports or 16. And then you'd get, you know, 32 users or 64. And then there was the, well, this is still taking up too much backplane space. The computers are getting faster. And then there's like, well, let's connect over the network. So that's where terminal servers came into be. Instead of having hardwired terminals to interface cards that plugged into the backplane, the computer was now fast enough and the network was now fast enough that you have a small computer, which would have the serial ports on it, and then a processor, and it would speak some protocol over the Ethernet to get back to the computer. Well, when I started at Cisco, the world was becoming TCP/IP. So we had a multi-protocol terminal server. We had one which did TCP/IP, and Telnet over TCP/IP, and then DEX LAT protocol, which was a protocol that ran over raw Ethernet frames.
That is basically where you started, was working on these terminal servers. What kind of challenges did you face trying to build terminal servers from Cisco? I mean, so this was not a typical typical operating system. It was iOS, and you weren't working on interface cards for any sort of computer. You were actually working on interface cards for for this odd operating system.
We were kind of a second class product at Cisco. Everything was all about work on the router. We actually had two products. We had what we called a protocol translator and a terminal server. And a protocol translator is essentially a terminal server that runs over virtual terminals. The idea being that maybe you'd have, there were three protocols we could do. We could do LAT, we could do X25, which was a way to have remote terminals over the public switch telephone network, and Telnet. So someone could connect to us via X25 and then Telnet into a machine or do those permutations. But it really was the same thing because it was like virtual terminal ports connecting in and then terminal ports out. But we were like the second class citizen product. So oftentimes, we didn't even get our hardware from Cisco. We got this this product we had. We called it the STS-10 from Rockwell, and it was terrible. But we made do, but it didn't have enough memory. And then the 500CS, that one was one that we had actually designed, but still we had to go out to another hardware company to build it for us because Cisco is, all the hardware engineers were too busy there getting new routers out. And the biggest challenge there was that the chip vendors didn't know we were Cisco. Even though Cisco was small then, Cisco was small and growing, but we used like Emulex, some company that Motorola did like no business with except for this one contract for us. And I was running into a CPU bug that was causing what looked like memory corruption. So I was driving myself crazy trying to find the software problem. And I eventually concluded this must be hardware. We call up Motorola, and Motorola says, oh, you're just doing this for Cisco. And then finally they pay attention to us months later. You know, they've been ignoring all of our tickets, you know, and yeah. So, but yeah, I had to write everything from scratch, drivers for all the hardware. Fortunately, there was some sharing. We used the same Ethernet chip as did the Cisco like low-end router, so we didn't have to write that. But for all of our serial chips, that was all stuff we had to do. Terminal servers had a kind of, started calling them communication servers because people started dialing in from their PCs, and instead of just running Telnet or LAT or these things which were character-oriented protocols, people started running SLIP and PPP, so they ended up being low-end routers. And then at the very, very, very dying end of dial-up, there was this innovation called 56K modems. And the way that these worked was because you couldn't actually get 56K as an analog signal. You can only, the underlying channel is 64 kilobits, but because of the way their signaling works, it's really 56, which means the highest tone you could get is half that, or 28,800. So there were, for a long time, these 28,800 baud modems that were thought to be the theoretical max. And then some modem guys had this idea, well, if you actually didn't go modem to modem and didn't convert digital to analog and then analog to digital, but instead had a digital connection on your server side, then you could construct, using a digital signal processor, a waveform which would on the far end, its digital to analog converter would, or no, I'm sorry, the other way around, that's because it's, yeah, it's analog to digital converter could reconstruct a 56K waveform. So that actually meant that now there were communication servers which connected to primary rate ISD, or either primary rate ISDN or T1 lines, and they were there for bigger boxes and data centers. And then Cisco cared and became a more mainstream product, but that was right before they all died and everything went to broadband. So it was kind of funny. There was like a, yeah, this is getting less and less, but as more university connections and stuff are going to, you know, Ethernet to the dorms or whatever. But then there was a last like bubble of excitement as terminal servers became a high-end thing to become to support 56K modems, and then they were obsolete.
Well, I remember terminal servers being used for a long time still to dial in, even when I was in Cisco Tech for a very, very long time, using, I don't know, you know, some sort of VPN software or something that you might call it.
Well, that's kind of what I meant, was there was definitely a long tail of that, but they did end up becoming, instead of being these small boxes with racks of modems attached, like we used to make, you know, 16 port device, you'd connect 16 modems. But to make this transition to the 56K modems, you had to do 24 digital modems at a time, because a T1 line is 24 digital circuits. So that's when it was actually scaling up, and service providers, you know, didn't have just like, you know, 16 modems. They were doing hundreds of dial-in lines. So that's what actually made it be a more mainstream product. But it was really, you know, when I say the end, I think this is probably like 1995 until people stopped using dial-ups.
I mean, even America Online and big customers like that were using tons and tons of these, from what I remember, for a long, long time, long into the 80s and maybe even the 90s, late 90s and stuff.
Oh, well, that's what I'm saying, is that it was the late... Until the late 90s, a lot of this was racks of modems, but then there was a transition in the like mid 90s to the 56K modems, where it was like a highly concentrated, the density got much higher. Before, service providers were buying individual phone lines, they were connecting individual modems to them, and the phone companies were even having a hard time with this. They were, because of the way their switches worked, they had to like balance the load across the different like subsections of their internal crossbars. And they were like, you know, we don't even understand this. Why are all these people suddenly having all this dial-up now, you know, when it exploded? And then it became a digital service. And yeah, I had some friends who their first business out of college was running an internet service provider in Ashland, Oregon. And they did exactly that. They just ordered like 8 phone lines. That's what they started with. And they just scaled up and just had more and more racks of gear. And a few years after that, then it turned into something that was more a high-end operation.
Would you say that in the early days, you were mostly still working down in the core of the code, right? Because you were doing, were there any interesting problems that you ran into there, or anything that was...
Oh, you asked about the whole run to completion thing in Cisco IO. So it turns out there were all kinds of issues with threads. I'll call them threads, you know, in Cisco IOS calling some function which had previously been written to work only with the router's console terminal, which the designers had decided it never wanted to get behind and drop characters, so it used polled output. So if you had a 9600 on console and there was lots of output, it would actually slow down the router. Well, when you were connected in, say, via a network connection, then those functions would block, and then something else would run, and there were all of these race conditions. And nowhere, anywhere in Cisco IOS were there any locking mechanisms. So one had to just rethink all of this stuff. There was a race condition that I found between the device drivers and the TCP stack that required me to rework the entire, every reference to every shared buffer in the system, which at that time was some like relatively low number, like 70 source files, but it was a crazy thing to fix. And we, you know, it was a lots and lots of bugs came out of the wash there because, you know, we just kept pushing on what was essentially this run to completion, no locking, and you'd call some function and maybe it would block, maybe it wouldn't. There were no conventions.
Why do you need to lock any code, you know, or lock any memory locations?
So I did basically, you know, the productization of my work was the communication servers, but I had the TCP stack and Telnet in and out. So on the routers, you would have the same code running, but it would be for remote administration. So someone would Telnet into our routers, type a show command, and which was following all of these linked lists. And when you tried them on the console, it was all good. And when you tried them over a network connection, it would fail and crash the box because any exception and any thread crashed the whole thing. And it was always supposedly my fault because, well, it works on the console and it doesn't work over Telnet and it's your Telnet. And so, yeah, that's a lot. Had to do a lot to make that all stable.
Yeah, actually, at that time, from what I remember, iOS's CLI show commands were essentially just walking through. It was actually a header file, and it was just a walking this linked list built out of header files that were compiled into the code, and to figure out what was default and what wasn't, you just looked at a global memory variable, and everything actually was global memory.
It was a flat memory model. So everyone had access to everyone else's pointer, which is fun.
Until it gets to a million lines of code.
Yeah. You had to do in your loops. Yeah. Yeah. Well, what would happen is something would be in the middle of this data structure and get freed, and you would follow the link to next pointer and jump off into space. So what I had to do is make all of the show loops just say how far into the structure they were. So instead of saying, you know, for link equals link head, link is not nil, link equals link next, which is how you'd normally traverse a linked list, you'd basically, you know, say, you know, for I equals zero, onward. And then you'd start at the beginning of the list, iterate that many to find that item, because if you were running in a loop, you're not going to block. You fetch everything you might need, and that's a pointer, so that we would never follow any bad pointers, and then collect all the information, then you print it out, then you continue in the loop again. So maybe it would print something twice, or maybe it would skip something if something changed in the linked list, but that's how we had to harden every single show command.
Let's walk through some of the models of the devices we're talking about here, because, again, a lot of people aren't going to even know what we're talking about at all.
The model numbers that stick out in my head are the ones that I worked on. I'd have to look online to tell you the other ones. But the first terminal server, I think we sold, you could get one of the smaller chassis with a multi-port card in it. But that was a kind of expensive solution. But we had something, we called it the Trouter, which I think was like the terminal server router. And we didn't sell a lot of those. But, at the time, Cisco has a architecture was a multi-bus, and we had a processor card and then a bunch of network cards. And so we had a multi-bus that had a bunch of UARTs on it. UART, sorry, the hardware device that you connect to serial ports. And so we had the Trouter was the first combo terminal server router.
So what was that based? Again, you know, you're saying this, but was it based on anything that was already a Cisco, like an MGS, AGS, or anything like that?
It was like an AGS. It was smaller. I think it was like an MGS. It was a smaller chassis. So it was the same CSC1, CSC2, CPU card. I think maybe you could put the MCI on it for 4 Ethernets. And I think there were some 3COM Ethernet cards that worked. And then we had this multi-port terminal board. So that was like the first version. And the protocol translator was the same thing, except it didn't have the terminal card in it. So it was a few Ethernets and a processor. And then as a dedicated terminal server, we went first to, I think it was Rockwell as an OEM. And the product that we called that was STS-10 or STS-10X. I think the 10X had more memory. And that had 10 ports, if I recall correctly, and Ethernet. And the hardware was terrible. One thing we had done was we wanted an extra baud rate, I think maybe 38,400 baud. One of the baud rates requires you to program a special clock generator. And the firmware from, I guess, that's not how Rockwell used it. They used that to generate a constant time interrupt to run their real-time clock. Well, there was another oscillator we were using. We didn't know the difference until we discovered that the time was very like fast or slow, and every box was different. And that using that other RC resistor capacitor oscillator was a bad idea. But we were already committed; we couldn't give up the baud rate. So I like scratched my head, and I thought, well, I wonder if it's just box to box variant or how much it drifts. And I discovered that I could use at system startup, I could time the RC oscillator using the crystal oscillator and then calibrate it. And that worked good enough. And then the box would like not lose, like it was losing like a couple of minutes or gaining a couple of minutes a day. And, but it turns out that it was good enough that you could at startup measure it. And then, you know, close enough. We didn't have NTP back then.
So it was every single box had a different clock speed, but there was consistent on that box.
Well, yeah. Well, it was an interrupt clock. Yeah, it was an interrupt. So it was a periodic interrupt timer. So yeah, like so that's how we knew wall time. And yeah, they didn't use it in their software. And when we told them about it, they said, yeah, that's probably a terrible interrupt source.
Wow. So that's really down in the hardware level of doing stuff then is where you had to be.
Oh yeah. I mean, we were bare level application, had to know every chip on the board. And then we brought up the next one was the 500CS. And that's the one where we had used this Motorola part and it was, there was a problem in the memory controller. And I drove myself crazy trying to figure it out because it was brand new hardware. The software was brand new. We have no idea what the missing piece is or what's going on. And again, that was the same thing where it's, you know, we were writing a bare level, you know, bare metal application, have to write drivers for every chip on that.
And that's what happens when you have to go to, with new hardware, you have to go down to the basic. Like it's like, you don't necessarily have any, a lot of people don't understand. You don't really have, you have manuals, but those may or may not be right at all. Those may be completely out the window as far as being.
Yeah. And there's so many variables. Like in this case, there was a workaround that you have to do in some of the programmable logic, as you know, around what we call glue logic around the processor. And once we actually talked to the right person at Motorola and said, well, we saw a similar problem in like this companion part, try this workaround. And then, oh, great, now we can make progress on our product. And these days, the bring up is usually done now that the higher degree of integration, you have a lot more in one part. There's these system on a chips, and a lot of that bring up is done by the vendor. And then when you have an OEM build your hardware for you, they haven't changed the design very much. But and found that we had another, this is not when I was at Cisco anymore, well, it's a company that eventually got acquired by Cisco, Meraki. I was doing a switch bring up, and all seemed well, except that during my software update process, I was noticing that I was getting checksum errors. And I thought, oh my God, there's some kind of memory corruption going on here. And it turns out that to save money at the last minute, our designer had gone from using, I think it was Micron DRAM to Samsung. And there's some subtle difference. And the vendor said, we never qualified that part, you know, and our, you know, the chip vendor was like, that's not going to work. We don't know about that. That'll be months. And so we're glad that we found it because they had to at the last minute substitute back the more expensive Micron memory. But yeah, these things are very complicated, and just using a different memory chip that supposedly is compatible, has all the same specs, is, you know, it's all bets are off.
Well, nowadays, I would think that a lot of this is done in emulation, that the initial phases are all done emulating the chipset.
Oh, well, sure. But they do that with initially one kind of qualified part, because they're doing external I/O to something, like say an external memory chip or something. So they try, like, okay, we know we're going to do all of this based on this particular, you know, DDR4 chip at this clock rate with this requiring this many clock cycles. And our vendor had substituted a unqualified part.
A part that hadn't been tested, yeah, at all. So you didn't know if the timing would work or the power would work or anything.
We didn't realize that they had even made this substitution, and neither had the chip vendor, because the chip vendor would have told them not to, and I would have told them not to.
The excitement of working around some of this hardware when you're not expecting people to do things the way that you had, that they had said they were going to, or whatever.
Yes. Turns out hardware engineers are just negotiating, how do we get the cost down? And they're like, well, we can substitute the Samsung to this Micron. It's got the same specs, and no one knows it makes a difference. It appears to work, except under very high load. You know, that was what it was. It ran great as a switch. The only reason we noticed it was when we do an upgrade, we do a lot of cryptographic checks. We do SHA-1 and SHA-256s, and that's much more compute than anything that happened when switching packets, so we never noticed data corruption or anything in any other context. Mostly that CPU was idle on that hardware. The CPU just did occasional management if somebody was checking up on the switch or whatever, but mostly it was idle.
So see, this is the importance of understanding how this stuff is built, that it's not just a matter of throwing stuff together or whatever. There's actually a lot of chance even in what comes out the other side, that you don't always know as the hardware guy working on it that this particular thing is going to take place. So you're kind of sitting there trying to figure things out. And
every time we change anything from the reference, see, the exciting thing is to change things from the reference design, because that's what differentiates your product. But as soon as you do, you find out, like, oh wow, none of this works right. There was a problem that I just recently had to fix in something that runs the Linux kernel, where there is very common EEPROM. It's called an AT24, used all over PC hardware. And we're building this high-end server. And the hardware guy said, well, I'll just put in an AT128, which is it's got more storage. It's usually these things store Ethernet addresses. There's no reason to make it bigger, but you wouldn't think there would be any harm. However, once you go to the larger part, it means it goes to 2-byte addresses, not 1-byte addresses. And it turns out that Intel SM bus controllers are very picky about their packet formats they're willing to send. And they, unless you do a lot of weird work, do not like to send commands to these parts. And it's like, the hardware guy is like, oh, I'm doing you a favor, I'm getting you a larger part there. And then you're like, have to dig and dig and dig and find out that it's not really software compatible. On the other hand, a lot of the other embedded architectures, their I2C. So SMBus is restricted I2C. It turns out if you put it on an I2C controller, it works just fine. But Intel has their limited function SMBus. You put it on that, it doesn't work at all. So I wouldn't have known this, because I've worked much more on ARM and PowerPC and MIPS and those architectures than on PCs. And on PC, you make the substitution, you need to find a weird Linux kernel patch. You do it on any other architecture, it just works.
Wow. So it's much more complex on the lower end than people might think, like towards the hardware.
All across the board, because it's just some architectures have quirks. And until you work in them a lot, you don't know them. You're like, now I know. Like, okay, yeah, it's problematic to replace that AT32 with anything bigger on x86 hardware, even though, you know, you've seen it done fine on ARM, no problem, or whatever. It's all these just things you have to learn over time.
So what was your worst project?
After I left Cisco the first time, I came back to do a spin-in called AYR Networks. It was a secret project at Cisco to develop essentially what's now called software-defined networking. We had it pretty early, and then Cisco people panicked and thought this should never see the light of day. It'll turn everything into a commodity. Eventually that happened, but we had it in 2001. We had it a long time before. And I was given the stretch goal of running on the Cisco 7200. The main focus was the 6500, which had all this hardware switching. And they, because we were like a secret project, we had a lot of recycled gear and stuff out of Cisco labs. And they gave me this particular, I think it was called an NPE 300 processor card. And I had taken off several years to be a full-time parent. I had still been dabbling in system software, but I hadn't done it for a while. And like the first stuff comes up great. I see console.io, but then as soon as I start to try to get the PCI bus to work, nothing makes any sense. And I'm just thinking, have I forgotten how to do this? Have I, like, you know, lost it? And then I find out, I just start, as I experiment, look in registers, it takes me months. I figure out that there's all these weird problems with byte swapping that aren't documented. And if you issue bus transactions of certain alignment, they don't work. They hang the bus. And I work through all of these. I get the thing to work. And I'm like, wow, that was so difficult. I must, like, really be, like, losing my edge. It took me like three times longer than I thought. And I'm sharing this with a friend of mine, an old Cisco manager. And he said, they give you that hardware to do bring up? Oh, the guy who had to bring up Cisco IOS quit after 6 months because he couldn't admit to his manager that he couldn't figure it out. There are so many errata on that show. And I just start, like, it just turned out to be an accident. They didn't do it to me on purpose. But, like, my first thing after not having worked, you know, in tech for a few years is to give me the board that broke somebody else's career. And I did get it to work, though. I did get it to run Linux, and it was great eventually. And they also, somebody else eventually got it to run iOS. But that's why, like, it was lost in lore that the person who does the bring up of this may lose their mind.
So are you sure it was not on purpose?
I don't think it was on purpose at all. You know, the people there were good friends of mine. I think that there's this part called the GT64120. It was a system controller that connected to a MIPS processor, and it was where it was its PCI bus master. And the first revision of that chip, you know, despite their simulation and all, the first rev of that system controller was full of bugs. When I got to get a follow-on board, which had the next rev of the chip, none of those bugs were there. And I was like, oh God, you could have gave me an NPE 400. I would have been done faster than my early estimates. But instead, you know, I had all this self-doubt and stuff, and it took me so much longer than I thought it should.
Thanks, Kevin, for coming on. I'll let you know when this post.
Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you. That was fun.
Subscribe to The History of Networking on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.